Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning into The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. Reviews are always welcome, and please leave comments or questions as we are likely to address them during our panel discussion on the last Monday of the month on Facebook Live, as well as posted here on the podcast that following Friday.
Great. Welcome, everyone, to the first podcast episode. Let's go around and have each host introduce themselves, names, pronouns, theater disciplines, and where you're currently residing. Shalana, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, my name is Shalana Wunsch, and I use she, her pronouns. I would like to acknowledge that I am on the traditional land of the Coast Chehalis people, including the Duwamish people, past and present. I honor with gratitude this land itself and the Duwamish tribe, and this acknowledgement does not take the place of authentic relationships with Indigenous communities, but it serves as a first step in acknowledging the land and honoring the land that we are on. And I identify as a actor, teaching artist, producer, stage manager, photographer now as well. Alex, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Totally. I am Alex Lee Reed. I am residing on the land of the Coast Salish people and the Duwamish people here in West Seattle. I use he, him, or they, them pronouns. As an artist, I identify as writer, director, teacher, mentor, advocate.
And I'm Ana Sofia Villanueva. I use she, her pronouns. I am a theater producer, director, writer, and activist. And I am currently residing on traditional unceded Yakima land in central Washington. So each week, the hosts will introduce themselves, as there are 12 badass artist activists who make up this collective. So you'll continue to hear new voices and differing perspectives with each episode. So before we dive into the discussion, I'd like to start with a personal check-in. I have found it beneficial to start rehearsals and sometimes meetings with check-ins. And that's where we briefly go around and share where we're at. While sometimes check-ins can allow for someone to leave matters at the door, the intention is really more of an acknowledgement that we are all real people with real lives outside of work. So by sharing what we are bringing into the room, it also helps us to take a moment to actually see the person, or as they write in this article we're going to discuss, the who is as important as the what. So check-ins also help us know how to support one another that day. For example, at the beginning of a rehearsal, if an actor came in and shared that they just underwent like a horrible life event, I might change the rehearsal plan from working on a traumatic scene to something else that day. So yeah, let's go ahead and do check-ins. I'll go ahead and start. I am feeling really nervous. I'm super excited about this being our first episode. And nerves are good. Every time I tell people that I am nervous, they say, oh, you shouldn't be, or it's going to be okay. And I've always found that nerves are really great. It's usually the things that I care most about that make me the most nervous or afraid. So directing or facilitating, or if I'm about to go in and do like a really heavy lift, I get some performance anxiety, which is great because I haven't had that a whole lot this year. So I'm really excited to have performance nerves right now. So that's what I'm coming in with.
I'm also feeling a little bit nervous too. There's something about recording something that like solidifies it. And so this is just a kind of a nerve-wracking thing to be recording something, even though I can go back in and edit in theory, whatever I want, but it's just nerve-wracking. So that's a little nerve-wracking, but I'm excited, and I'm excited to see like what comes of the conversations and like what comes specifically of this conversation, but also like thinking longevity as well as we like are looking at this podcast, what that looks like.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
I would echo the nervous note just for continuity, you know. but more excited than nervous, and excited because like this is just what we do, right? We're just doing it on the record.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Personally, I'm in a really, really strange, muddy, sticky place. I don't know. My mom died, and that's complicated. Mm-hmm. And I'm also in the process of moving, and also just like navigating a lot of pieces, all of which I think are also related to these conversations that we're having. So using this, our podcast, as an opportunity also to navigate kind of these personal journeys that I'm on, as well as the bigger professional, global, stuff.
Thank you. And I'm sorry to hear about your mom.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think that like navigating that is kind of why we started the podcast, of like figuring out how to navigate this landscape that is our current theater in the US, and potentially looking at others as well as we continue on. So why we started the podcast was just that I had an assignment for my graduate class, and it was like to create like an open educational resource type dealio for under like the Theater of the Oppressed umbrella. And I realize that I'm talking a lot with my hands and no one can see them. and so Anna Sophia and I were connecting really shortly to when that assignment was due, just on like a casual, like get like seeing where we were in our lives. And I asked if she would be willing to do the like some sort of interview with me for that. And from that process, we went into it feeling really, really exhausted. But after the conversation, we felt rejuvenated. We felt like we had actually been able to dig into these things that like we had been ruminating about, that like she had been writing about, that like we had had conversations with other people about, but we didn't really get to dig in. But we really got to dig in and kind of like figure out, like talk about different ways of structure. And so afterwards we were like, okay, well, she was like, let's do a podcast. And I thought that would be a great idea. And so as we were starting to like plan everything, we realized that it wasn't just our voices that we wanted to privilege, because we are connected to some really amazing people. In fact, we're connected to more than 10 people. those 10 people that have joined us have been really, are really, really wonderful people, and their voices deserve to be heard for many, many reasons. And so it's kind of exciting to get to like dive in and digest this information together. And like Alex said, it's things that we have been doing, and now we're just recording it as like a way to like share that with other people, so that like people can hear what we're trying in our community. We can hear what our fellow 10 other people or 11 other people are doing, and like what they're doing in their communities, and how we can incorporate that parts of it into our community potentially if it works, like just a way to like continue that bouncing of ideas and continuing education, because I'm really passionate about education. So yeah, Anna Sophia, is there anything else you'd like to add about like why we started this thing and like what?
Pretty much everything you said, and just maybe like reiterating, I'm an eternal optimist. so I view this having to do virtual work, at least a part of it, as an opportunity to get some amazing people from across the country in the same virtual
room. So that's a big part of why I wanted to start. But I've also been needing to have conversations with queer and or BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. The conversations that we've been having about power dynamics in theater, in the theater industry forever, but on a public platform. And I think that was the main impetus for me. Well, cool. So I talked a little bit about the formatting. So we are, each episode, we're going to center on an article or critical source material and talk about how that pertains to the theater industry. The first article we're discussing today is titled What Dream Casts May Come, and it's published on the American Theater Magazine on December 10th. The article is also posted on our Facebook page if you want quick access to it. And so the article poses the question, which plays and which actors would you most like to see matched? And then prevalent theater artists and leaders from across the country wrote in responses. Many responded with a classical text and list of predominantly BIPOC or marginalized actors that they would like to see cast. But there are also a few who challenged the prompt altogether, such as Lisa Fortes, a director and the head of directing at DePaul, as well as playwright Lee Edward Coltson, who points out that the question inherently centers whiteness, as the canon is comprised by stories written by, for, and with white actors in mind. So I definitely want to circle back to this critical counterpoint, but let me start by asking both of you this question. Which theater artist gave your favorite response to the prompt and why?
I want to jump in on that right away because his response was probably my favorite.
Great.
And totally aligns with my own feelings about the question and where we're going. And right, so he did play along, but the comment is that reimagining plays that already exist with Black, Brown, Queer, BIPOC artists isn't really doing any service to us. And also, on a brief fun side, I don't know how to pronounce her name. Ada Karamanian, help me out, anyone?
Karamanian.
Yeah. So I just love this as the biggest Julie Briskman fan in Seattle. Her response, Seattle actors Mary Ewald and Julie Briskman as Vladimir and Estragon in A Femme Led Waiting for Godot. I would admittedly just watch the crap out of that. I would love that. And my other, sorry, we said favorite, but I have a top three. my other favorite is Marshall Jones III, who is a director, proposed a kind of double build, double cast parallel with Raisin in the Sun and Pipeline.
I want that too. That'd be cool.
Oh, I want that.
Yeah.
I would love that format of a classical, or how we define classical, paired with a new works, and how both can comment on each other and maybe be critical even of each other. I think.
Yeah, that might be an exciting thing for us to explore. As like options for how it could be different, like, because some of the texts, like, I think somebody mentioned, I don't remember who, but somebody in this article mentioned that this isn't necessarily the conversation we should be having, but there's also some really great ass roles in some of these things too, like there's some great characters. And just so you know, this will not be this will be an explicit podcast. Probably will not control that. But that was really exciting. Yeah. I'll jump in and do mine if you don't have anything else to add, Alex.
No, not yet.
Okay. My favorite, I agree. I'll save the ones that are like kind of going about like challenging the question itself, because those were ultimately my favorite. But I did like David Kurz, the artistic director of Deaf West Theater, talking about deaf students and how like they're using ASL, and specifically like how deaf kids are expressing and playing with TikTok. Mm-hmm. Because I see it all the time. And it is a really cool thing. And there's just something about deaf theater that like really like individuals they have who are deaf have this connection to body that I don't think anybody else can have, because that's how they communicate. And so I remember seeing The Hunchback of Notre Dame at Fifth Ave a few years ago now, and it was one of the first shows that I had seen by myself, and like watching that show was so incredibly moving in so many different ways. Like the music is just wonderful to begin with, but like the way that that actor, and I don't remember his name and I feel like I should, the way that he was able to like use his body in like ways that I had never fully, like I could never do, like his connection to body is just wonderful and magical and like unreal. And even if I wanted to replicate it, I never could. So like finding that empowerment for students is really exciting. Because I'm so passionate about helping students, I'm like, yeah, how can we get you to do a play on TikTok? And I actually, side note, just found out that there is a play on TikTok. I saw that as I was scrolling through Facebook last night. No idea what it is or how it works, but I'm like,
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my favorites. Yeah, again, I loved what Lisa Portes said, but I also like what Michael John Garces, artistic director of Cornerstone Theater Company, and Thomaso Rodriguez, the artistic director of Ars Repertory Theater, wrote. And not just because they're all Latinxes. Although I have been reading up about artist repertory theater and found out that Thomaso Rodriguez is the first Latinx artistic director of a Lort Theater. And that happened in 2016, which is mind-blowing. As the largest racialized group in this country, it says something about Latinx representation and our status within this country and industry. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, I like what Mi Gente is bringing. And as to Damaso's response, he selected the play The Skin of Our Teeth by Thornton Wilder and listed artists for the lead roles. And then for the casting of the ensemble in the play, he wrote as many people from the community as possible, hundreds over the course of the run. Every performance, when the play breaks in Act 3, a new cast from the community will step in as themselves to save it. And Michael John Carsis wrote, I think my real dream and where I am and have had the privilege of deriving inspiration since long before the pandemic would be to work with people from all walks of life. From the infinitely complex fabric of communities around me, people who bring fresh energy to the notion of performance and who bring authenticity of voice, but real depth of characterization too. Huh. So I love both of those statements, but they're both just so forward thinking and bring really like a fresh lens on what community engagement could look like. So those were some of my favorite responses. Cool. Well, I have to ask, how would you answer the question? What is a dream play or a way of flipping the script that comes to mind for you?
You want to go first?
Yeah, I can go first. So right before this national pandemic, I was in a show of Romeo and Juliet, and it was a queer show. It was a queer rendition of Romeo and Juliet, and I realized that this has been done before. But I don't know. There's something really magical about that story being having a queer Romeo and Juliet. There, and like I don't know. It changes the meaning, especially of like the palm to palm. Like touch is like different, and there's so much reference to touch, and I don't know, there's just something very, very captivating about that in my brain and my mind. So I think I would love to continue to explore like what exactly that is, because we only had a week of table readings and like two blocking days before we all got X made out of seeing people for months.
You don't know what it is specifically about the first time?
I think it's because there's something about Romeo and Juliet's love. And specifically in the rendition that we were doing, Juliet hadn't really quite realized that she was queer. And when she sees Romeo and realizes who he is or who they are, it's like that realization of like that love, it doesn't have these boundaries that we think that they do, because she had lived under these ideas of those boundaries, but then realizing that the person that she's seen and who she loved, it didn't matter in the end, it was just who she loved. There are problems with the fact that they die, and more stories of queer death is not necessarily what I am after at all. But there is something really special about that love, and I'm a sucker for love, and so Romeo and Juliet, I love that story anyway.
Thanks for letting me press you. I think that's such a beautiful response. I'm so curious as to who you were going to play.
So I was going to play Mercutio, and in our rendition, Mercutio, when she was in school, or when she was in grade school, she was in a relationship with Tybalt, and then when she left for college, she discovered herself and realized herself, which is something that speaks really close home to me as a human being. And when she comes back to the city and she sees Romeo and Benvolio trying to figure their shit out, she becomes this role model for them, this person that can be there for them and stick up for them and help them navigate as they're also navigating through that. And I think there's also something really beautiful about that too, because the Mercutio relationship, particularly with Benvolio, is something that really captivates me. And is really exciting. And so being that mentor figure, and also probably at some point, a crush figure of it's for me, when I was the first person that I had fully realized that I was queer, and the first person that I met, I was oh my God, I'm not alone in this experience that I've been having. Cause I grew up in Idaho for the most part. So there wasn't, People did not express themselves in the way that they do in other places.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I love that. Just hit me in my feels. So my answer is not nearly as in-depth as Shalana's, which is totally cool. It's not a comedy.
Yeah.
So I, after reading this article several times, I'm really interested in the road of future classics. A couple of the artists who responded in this article talked about future classics and the plays that don't yet exist. And so I kind of came up with my dream collaboration. And I want to direct this play, absolutely, if we're dreaming, you know. But this play is a kind of in the genre of magical realism. It's a collaboration that's written by Katori Hall and Lynn Nottage. That just deals with Black joy and abundance, but in a really magical and exciting way, because that's, you know, I think about Shakespeare a lot, right? And in the comedies, right, there is often magic. And there is always love, and the kind of journey and confusion and self-recognition and all of this. But I'm interested in how we do all of those things that Shakespeare does in this still really huge, grand, magical way, but through the lens of contemporary Black women. And I think that it's rather than a remount or an adaptation, it's an entirely new imagining. And this cast in this magical, whatever, abundant black joy, love, and magic story features Lupita Nyong'o, Michaela Cole, Octavia Spencer, and Karen Robinson. And it will be just like the best shit you've ever seen.
Huh. That's exciting. Yeah.
I love that. It's interesting. I love that notion of future classics, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Like, because maybe that's not future; it's more contemporary. But you know, I'd done a lot of work with the students at the Guthrie BFA program, and so far that's been the most joy I've had as a director. And I've had questions about how do I get better with language? How do I get better with classical texts? And I often tell them, like, just go to plays, contemporary plays that use heightened language. Mm-hmm. I told a Latinx student, just, you know, I was like, read Jose de Vera. Are you kidding me? That's so, it's beyond Shakespeare. It has all of those themes. It's also that beautiful, romantic, stylized language and mix of poetry that is just suddenly grounded and real and incredibly human. So no, I don't think we have to go back in order to connect with some of these amazing things that have come out of classics. And yeah, maybe that is future classics. I love that.
Okay, but what's yours?
What's mine? Yeah. Oh, well, I have a couple because I break rules too, Alex. So I have always wanted to direct Sarah Ruhl's Eurydice with a Spanish, and by that I mean by way of Spain, Spanish feel to it. Like, I think about like this, I don't have it fully realized as I actually am morally against imposing concept before doing the work. But right now, just some things that are come to mind is like the strings of the house and like the notes that Orpheus hears and he, or maybe she or they plays as like a Spanish guitar, and the underworld with like this colonial architecture and the sounds of church bells. Okay. And I also love the idea of centering a Latina for the role of Hedda in Hedda Gabler. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I am curious about casting a non-Black Latina for the part of Iago in Othello. Okay, so I think that could be interesting in terms of showcasing both privilege and oppression within BIPOC communities. And having a woman, and especially a woman of color, you know, we're often required to do the job on top of the job. Like, in addition to our full-time workload, we are, you know, we're the organizers and mentors and often educators to our white male bosses. So the idea of Iago then being passed over by a less qualified man is significant. And then assuming Othello is not Middle Eastern, although that would be interesting too, but assuming Othello is Black, I wonder what that might say and generate questions in terms of anti-Blackness within Latinx and other BIPOC communities, questions about tokenism, and where the dynamics being explored are for BIPOC audiences. But yeah, I have not done my dramaturgy, and I don't believe in imposing directorial concept before I've done my homework. But like I said, that's something I'm curious about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's do this. Let's get into the meat of this thing.
All right.
Which is at least what I think is like the thing that most drew me to this is that initial counterpoint there. Mm-hmm. This, because it generates beautiful conversation. We come up with some amazing ideas, but yeah. So my real question from this, my central question is, should we be approaching this moment of racial reckoning with the Black Lives Matter and we see white American theater movements at the forefront by inserting racial diversity into classical texts? Or should we be focusing our efforts on new works or future classics that are written by and for BIPOC artists and individuals and for BIPOC audiences, or something else completely entirely? So yeah, let's get into it.
Okay, I have strong feelings.
Great.
Okay, get over being polite. man, like, burn it down. Okay. Just burn it down. And like any time you burn something down, what is left? What survives, right? There are pieces. There are pieces of the foundation that are useful, right? We don't have to, we can't start entirely from scratch because the history exists, right? And the history that exists always will in some way inform what we're building going forward, even if when what we're building is a hard criticism of that history. So that's to say, right, like not every play by a white person ever is terrible. Okay. Not every play by a white person ever is problematic. And that's fine. And those things can exist. But I feel strongly that this our focus in moving forward can't be to try to fit the box that already exists, right? To continue to center the white stories and the white narrative and like to try to make there be room for us mm-hmm. within that, but mm-hmm. rather build a new system, a new structure, a new way of thinking of making art that is for us, that is by us, that is the stories that we want to tell without thinking about the white gaze, without having to assimilate or to fit or to sacrifice any part of our whole humans as mm-hmm. queer and BIPOC artists. Like just give us the resources. Okay. Give us those white dollars. We love to see it. And then let's put those dollars into Indigenous playwrights, into Black and Latinx playwrights, into queer and trans artists. That's the theater future that I want to see. And then once we as global majority have taken our space, then y'all can come back.
It's interesting. I agree with so much of what you're saying. I think most people would assume, and I often take the stance of burn it down. I don't actually think that's fully me. Like I actually, you know, it's a quote that I use often, that was said to me. I was once told that I have an unhealthy ability to empathize with my oppressors. True. Okay. For me, that being said, you know, I think that there is a place for white theater. I just don't think it should be the standard. You know, that's for me. And although I know I posed the question as should, I disagree with me, you know, as I'm thinking about that question that I pose, you know, I'm always hesitant with should or shouldn't, because I believe that leads to binary thinking, to complex issues. But I will say, I don't think we should stop at putting racial diversity on stage, because I do think that there needs to be greater representation. I do want to do Hedda Gabler. I might want to do Othello, and I'm not going to do it in the way that a white director has done it. I'm not. But we can't stop there. Like, you're absolutely right, Alex. Like, we need new business models, new producing approaches, operational structures, more authentic community engagement. We need to center stories for BIPOC audiences. I feel like that's a conversation that is not being had enough. And somebody, yeah. I don't have the quote here, but somebody did say that classic is like saying classic is a key word for white audiences. So
the word, it was Lee Edward Colston II. He's a playwright.
Yes.
And it's the word classic itself is and always has been a dog whistle that secretly means important to white people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I is 100% true. And that's why I am on team burn it down. Because, and like, I understand logically, because like there are so many wonderful plays that I would love to do that are in existence, that were written by white people. And that's great. And I don't think that those need to completely go away. I think that we can take those elements, but the system itself is, I believe, to be so corrupt and so centered around, it's built like the rest of our society around capitalism and white supremacy. And so therefore, there is no way in the way that it stands, I see, unless we completely break it down and rebuild. And I think that means that those stories need to be put away, and they can come back out. But I do think that they can be put away for now, as much as I love them and I will continue to read them. And I don't necessarily know how, like, if we should take them out of like teaching in general, because I think, but maybe the lens that we teach them through could be differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I hear you both. I completely understand. Also though, you know, I did love acting, and I don't pursue it. It's not something where I felt like I could do more good in other areas. But what I really loved as an actor, my greatest love, was Shakespeare. And you know, Shay Yu, playwright, director, and the former artistic director of Victory Gardens, wrote, I'm going to read this quote: "It would be a pure joy to see Asian American actors be invited to work on Chekhov." And similarly to me, I wasn't given those roles. Like, I couldn't. I would be, I was the evil seductress, or I was the frumpy best friend. You know, my hips either made me, you know, a maid or whore. Like, there's some weird, that's a weird dichotomy as a Latina. But I would have loved to do Shakespeare, and that wasn't open to me. And there should be Asian Americans doing Chekhov. I love Chekhov. But I hear you. I mean, if I hear you on the, like, let's move that aside. And maybe that is more inclusive mentality, and inclusion implies ownership of that table, that white supremacist table. So I get what you're saying. I'm so hesitant to saying it shouldn't be there altogether.
Okay. So not to say that it shouldn't be there altogether. And I think that's what I mean when I talk about like the relics and the rubble that are left after we burn it down. Right. And also this is going to take time, mm-hmm. right? We can't realistically, because, you know, capitalism and white supremacy, we can't just flip the switch and have it be better. And there is this in between time, right? There's this beautiful future that we're imagining, and also there's the right now. And in the right now, like, yes, let's do keep doing this work that we're doing. Let's dive into Chekhov, dive into Shakespeare and Ibsen. There also was a great dream cast of Cherry Orchard I felt super excited about. Squirrel. But right, so can't we simultaneously decolonize the classics? Like, say, yes, Anna Sophia, if you want to do Shakespeare, you fucking can. Like, or if we want to queer it up, we can. Or if we want to use Othello, which is also something that I thought about in my reimaginings. I'm interested in Othello as a commentary on anti-Blackness within the Black community. Mm. We can use the work that exists to do that while we're building these new things. Yes. I like this quote also from Lee Edward Colston II. I told you this was my favorite response. And the way he put it, he says, "This isn't to say that we shouldn't reimagine plays written by white writers that have historically been cast with white actors. However, it is an invitation to imagine beyond those writers and works to exclude them from the conversation in service of repairing the harm casting and programming has done to BIPOC artists and writers." Mm-hmm. And that's really, like, it's it's so much about reparations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I love that. That's feels like the great yes and. But something you're saying there about like it's taking time, I think that's where my fear about this prompt comes in, is that I've already made my stance on that clear of like, I don't think this is wrong. We need to do more. But my fear is that this is in the American Theater Magazine and this is their primary prompt. So it reinforces this fear I have that theaters are going to approach this this moment with only or solely with displays of racial diversity on stage and not taking it to really change things systematically. And what another quote that I'm going to read from here from one of the authors wrote, and it's not one of the authors, it's the author, and I just don't know their name of the person that sandwiched some of these responses. It says, the argument over the canon may have to wait for another day. And my question is, why? Like, no, yeah. It's going to take time, but let's not get hung up on the, we have to do the work. Like, it's not that we're, that's something that's later on once we accomplish diversity. I'm like, no, let's get to the, let's go beyond the D and the I, and let's get to the E already. Let's actually get to equity. Let's do that work.
Well, that's where the only change can actually happen. Like, we could, like, what shocked me most about this article was, like, the fact that it came out on December 10th, 2020. This feels like an article that should have come out at the beginning of people realizing that there's a big, major problem.
White people. Can we just...
Well, yes. Okay. Yes. 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 Yes.
New to many.
Great. Let us
no. Yeah. It, yeah. Sorry. For white people realizing that this was a major problem. Like, this feels like an article that should have come out months and months ago, but it came out not too long ago, 3 weeks ago.
So is this as far, is our criticism that this is as far as the conversation has gotten?
Ooh, yes.
Yeah.
On that scale of a platform, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sure, right, it's fun and it's lighthearted and mm-hmm. it's a palatable way into the conversation, but we gotta be, y'all, we are at least 9 months past palatable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Especially to be coming from the American Theater magazine. Why is this the, I feel like I have seen articles like this before. Mm-hmm. I have seen where people are trying to reimagine what representation we see on the stage. But in like how we break these barriers of white supremacy by casting people of color in these roles. But it's also like, why are we still here? Mm-hmm. It's frustrating. It's like, why have we, and that's where, I think that's where the burn it down comes from. It's like, mm-hmm. we need to move past this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we're just going to get stuck in it. And that's what I feel. That's what I fear, is like, we're just going to get stuck in it. And like, that's part of the reason why I think it's important to have these conversations and why we decided to put it in a podcast format where other people could potentially listen to it and hopefully listen to it. And like, also realize that, like, fuck yeah, this needs to change. You should have realized it months ago. Maybe this could be the thing that'll help. And maybe we can figure it out as we go along.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me that this whole article starts out, I'm going to do another quote, y'all. but it starts out with this amazing quote again by this mm-hmm. nameless author. And here's what it is. The stories told in the theater are more than text. They are also bodies, faces, persons. Words are made flesh and spirits breathe life into fictional worlds. Ah, that's gorgeous. And to me, that's a great reminder that at the other end, all of these plays are people. At the end, on the other spectrum of all of these decisions that are being made, are people. And so, like, while I love that quote, I feel like it's not addressing the thing that it's trying to say, which is that what does it mean then that this is the conversation that we're having? What does it mean to have bodies in roles that were not made for them? These are people. And how do we get beyond just having people displayed on stage? So I love that quote. And I also wish they would go the next step further. I wish the industry would.
Because a character on a...
Go ahead.
A character on a page is just a character on a page. Like, the actors and the team bring it to life. Like, yeah, how do we... We need to wake up and realize it. And I feel like there are a large amount of people who are starting to wake up and realize it. And then, you know.
Yeah, and I think something that doesn't... Oh, I'm sorry, Alex.
You're good. You're good. I'm just feeling mad over here. I've been feeling mad like since I moved to Seattle, because we just do so much processing. And it's like, I mean, not that things are a ton better in Detroit, not that things are better in the Midwest period, but just like, you know, we clip at a little faster speed. And I feel I'm like, maybe it's my transition to the West Coast that is kind of amplifying how slow all of this feels, right? Because Black, Indigenous, Brown, Queer, BIPOC artists are out here like screaming, this is the answer. This is the way to fix it. Period. And like, we're still just talking about it.
Yep. But I also think, right, we are talking about it. And yes, we are just talking about it, but I'm not sure how to articulate this. I feel like by talking about it, by sharing stories, right? That's what we do as theater artists. Like, I believe this is a transformative art form. I believe it's the most revolutionary art form. I believe talking about it and process can lead to results. We just have to make sure it is happening, that it doesn't end there. Yeah.
But how do we, like, say we, the three people in this room, right? How do we, without holding the institutional power, how do we move it forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the great question. You know, for me, I think it's a balance of working within and working without. It's making space where I can do that, where I can produce and make work and make space and mentor and uplift one another. I do that and I make time for that. When it is not at the compromise of my full spirit, mind, and body, working within to change things. Although there have been times where I let that go on too long, and it wasn't worth what was happening to me. But I think that's where I find it is working within and working without. How about you, Shalana?
I don't know. The more I think about it, the more I just want to work without. And maybe it's just because I don't hold any position of any sort of power in any theater that I work for. Like, I am considered bottom of the toll. Like, I'm a teaching artist. Like, we may keep their programs funded, but we don't have much say in like the runnings of the theater. And so maybe it's just because I don't get to work within, really. Like, there are elements that I do have influence over, but like, those aren't things that are going to systematically change. They don't feel as though they're systematically changing things. And so that feels as though then I'm like, well, if I can't work within, then I'm going to find a way to bypass that.
Yeah. I just have to say, though, as far as teaching and making change, I think of it as like, the ripple effects.
Mm-hmm.
This is what my dad says. He talks about the ripple effects of what you're doing. You may not always see it, but you are making change. And perhaps some of the best change you can make is through mentorship and teaching. So, Shalana, I think you are doing good.
Thank you. I try.
Yes.
I loudly echo that. I think that's to kind of answer my own question, I guess. I think that's a thing that as educators we can do. I, as educator and mentor, and also acknowledging that I'm in a middle leadership position in a large regional theater, like creating space for students or for the people who we mentor, where they have the freedom to dream and are encouraged to aggressively demand what they need from theater. Like we're holding the future generation of theater artists, or the upcoming generation of theater artists. Mm-hmm. And I think by modeling what truly equitable and inclusive practice can look like with young people, then right there, those are the values that they will then take forward into changing the world. So our screams are being heard somewhere.
Yeah, I also think as far as future theater leaders go, you know, even on like a super like business mentality, looking at what's happening in this country, you know, it's millennials are like half of the U.S. workforce. More and more young folks, Gen Zs, I forget the percentage on that, but Gen Zers are more and more queer and trans and non-binary. They're just breaking down a lot of those prescribed gender constructs. And we're also becoming a mixed race country. Like, so to me, it's like, you know, looking at what needs to change, we have this subscription model that is catered to predominantly white, wealthy audience bases, but that's not actually who this country is going to be. You know, Latinxes are going to be, are going to, I think it's at the same year that white folks are no longer the majority, I think that we're going to be the largest racialized. We are not permitted the status of race yet. So I say racialized because we certainly experience racism. so, you know, we'll be like the largest racialized group. At the same time, white folks are no longer the majority. So I'm also like, you know, from a awful business standpoint, like we have to invest in who this country is going to be, not only because it's the right fucking thing to do, but also because we want to survive as a business. So yeah, we better think about new ways of doing this business model, because they're not coming to the theater and they are not being supported. Mm-mm. So those are the changes that need to happen. So that's a really great, that I think that one's always a great incentive of like, you know, that question that happens. I do a lot of equity, diversity, and inclusion work in corporations. And I'm often asked by usually the person in charge, who's usually a white man, a cis white man, who asks, you know, the feedback is always like, oh, it's so empathetic. And I'm understanding that, you know, there's real people here, but what's the business incentive for diversity? And my response is always just, I have to tamper down some outrage because, you know, I'm like, are you asking why lives matter? Did you not read the sign? Like, really? Because it's the right thing to do because it's ethical. But also, like, I always want to flip that question around and say, why should I invest in you? You're not going to be the majority. You're not going to sustain us. You are not the business. Tell me why I should care about you and your children.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So, yeah, I do think, I think everything that y'all are saying is right, that we need to support and uplift the future leaders who are they're going to look different than the audiences that are being catered to now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, I'm gonna end this conversation with asking, what are some lingering questions that we have? Since we can't get to a place of answers, and we're not gonna give a roadmap or a checklist off to people, what are some things that, based on this conversation, that are still some questions that are still resonating? I'll start from that last conversation. I would say, where should theater makers, and particularly theater leaders, be putting their efforts in response to racial equity?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And just to expand on that question, because that's also the question in my mind, but equity across the board.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Right. Not just the American Theater article, I think, frames equity very much in terms of casting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the article is Wet Dream Casts, sure, but beyond just the actors and playwrights.
I think my lingering question is, like, what is the balance between burning it down and then doing things like this as well? Mm-hmm. I was like, is there a balance, or am I fully team burn it down still? Verdict is out.
Yeah, and I wonder what other ways we can flip the script on the canon or with casting that doesn't perpetuate more harm. So, okay, I'd like for us to do a closeout now. We did a check-in, and now we'll do a closeout. I tend to do closeouts differently all the time with more intense conversations. I might ask if anyone is holding on to anything or wish to discuss something further. But for perhaps for today's episode, I'll close out by asking this question. As our first episode in the new year, what is one thing you're looking forward to this year?
You know, you told me to think about this question.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like right now, I feel like I'm sitting on something and I don't know what that something is, but I feel like I'm like right at the edge. Like, it's like if you're going up a roller coaster, I feel like I'm right at like the point where it's gonna start like getting to the fun shit and like also the terrifying shit that's like the down and like the loops and the things. But I just feel like I'm like sitting on something and I don't know what that is, but I'm really excited for like what my further explorations, like through this podcast, through the projects that I'm working on, through like my own personal work, like what it is that is going to be that moment that like, that does like propel the whoosh de whoosh does.
Whoosh does, I love it.
Whoosh de whoosh does.
I'm looking forward to rebuilding. For me, in my life personally and also in my practice, 2020 was very much about identifying the problems and obstacles and burning a whole lot of shit down, metaphorically. I have not yet literally burned a thing, but I feel like despite everything, or in light of everything, I learned a lot last year, and I've become very clear about direction. So I'm looking forward this year to taking those lessons and putting them into practice actively, which is terrifying because it means doing basically everything I've ever done differently. But also, that's exciting.
Okay, personally, Shalana, I'm excited to run a marathon with you.
Half.
Okay, we're still on debate on how long it's going to be. And then also, yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to hearing more from the underrepresented, resilient badasses of this industry, many of whom are on this podcast. That's what I'm looking forward to. So, all right. Before we end things, I just want to do a quick shout out to other podcasters who are doing important work. I refuse to give into the scarcity mentality where we are pitted against one another. So for my first shout out is to my favorite podcast and who we are riffing, or more accurately, ripping off the format of discussing an article each episode. So Sippin' Tea in the Balcony, a BIPOC theater podcast hosted by Shanda Crudup and Ricky Ariza, two brilliant theater makers and critical thinkers who are breaking down many of the power dynamics within our industry. Super important podcast. Then there is Minneapolis podcaster Anna Hashizume, who does Thank You Places, to which I am a Patreon member. Anna does interviews with individual artists and talks a good deal about artist process, origin stories, and skincare routines.
And podcast I'm obsessed with is Intimacy Choreography in Conversation with Ann James and Carly D. Weckstein, who talk about intimacy choreography and shifting performing art spaces toward a culture of consent. I do recommend listening while taking notes. So much good stuff there. And if you're a podcaster applying a critical lens to theater, and I did not just mention you, please feel free to post your podcast on our Facebook page. Okay, bueno. Thanks, team.
Yeah, thanks. It's like post-show excitement is what I feel.
It's great. I love this.
Thanks again for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Please leave a review, comment, or question to be addressed during the monthly live panel discussion on the last Monday of the month. Or reach out to us via email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Herrera,
Lilia Hushman,
Lupika Shaw,
Oogie Push,
Saimukda Duampusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawks,
Shalana Wanch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Zahishta Vafadari,